Trust for Sustainable Living presents Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast about the environment and the issues our planet faces. Today, we will be talking to Elizabeth Wright, an Australian Paralympian medalist and a TEDx speaker, as part of our mini-series on climate action in response to the UN Climate Change Conference. Today's episode is hosted by Jasmine Barrett.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode. We are really, really happy and thrilled today with our guest, Elizabeth Wright, who is a Paralympian, writer, keynote speaker, and magazine editor, doing so much at the moment. So we would like to get to know a bit more about you. Can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about you and what you do now?
Of course. Thank you, Jasmine, so much for having me on the podcast. I'm really excited to be here. Yes, whenever I hear people kind of read out what I do right now, I get exhausted just hearing the list. But I think I do a lot of what I do because I'm so passionate about inclusion and diversity, particularly around disability. And kind of obviously as the years go by, more and more about climate change and all of that stuff, and really raising awareness about both aspects. And I'm Australian, as you can probably tell by the accent, but I've lived in the UK for 12 years now. And I was born and raised in Sydney, Australia. And yes, I was a Paralympian for Australia. I swam basically through my teen years. I think being Australian, we literally come out of the womb knowing how to swim, essentially. So I've just always loved being in water, always loved swimming. And it seemed such a natural thing to then go on and compete for my country. And I did that for several years and competed at two Paralympic Games, where I walked away with a silver medal and two bronze medals, which was really special because two of those medals were at my home games at the Sydney 2000 Games, which is revealing my age a little bit here, I think, because after the Sydney Games, I retired from my sport. And from then on, I went on, you know, I was a little bit lost for a while, but then I went on to university and I did two fine arts degrees because I think, you know, kind of challenging the stereotype of if you're a sports person, that's it, you're only ever interested in sport. But I've always been a really arty and crafty person, really interested in being creative and making things with my one hand because I'm limb different, so I only have one hand. And also just I think for me what's really important is that self-expression, and it's why essentially kind of as I've gone through my career, I've evolved into being a speaker, being a writer, and onto then being a magazine editor, because I love story and I love creativity in all its forms. And you know, I've kind of done speaking over the past 10 years. I've done a lot of writing over the years. That I've absolutely loved doing, and whether that's kind of, you know, at schools or at organizational level or charities or big business, you know, I've had some of my biggest clients recently, actually, which include Twitter and EA Games, which has been amazing. But, you know, for me, I think one of the biggest steps in the past few years has been doing magazine editing. I kind of fell into it as a role last year at the start of the pandemic, and we all had to pivot and suddenly find new ways of working and using our skills. And from that point onwards of editing Disability Review magazine, I now edit a startup magazine called Not Your Monolith, and then started my own magazine called Conscious Being, which I really wanted to create for disabled women and non-binary people, because I feel like we don't get that representation or really niche kind of specifics, especially when it comes to disability focused magazines. Because as I say to people, disabled women and non-binary people, we date, we have relationships, we get married, so on and so forth, we have careers, we have all of this stuff, we have life going on just as everybody else, so, but we don't necessarily get that kind of representational story heard. So I kind of, you know, I've built up a platform over the years which I think has been Really useful for a lot of campaigning and a lot of activism, and also the ability to amplify other people's voices, especially intersectionally. So I'm finding more and more as I go along that, I'm white. I'm relatively young still. I like to think I am. I'm only in my very early 40s. And I feel like there's, as much as I struggle to get a platform, I am privileged to a certain degree, especially in a lot of things that I really stand in my activism for. So I'm really trying to educate myself about the disability experience from a Black, Brown and Indigenous perspective. And I'm really consciously follow disabled people who are Black, Brown and Indigenous, because I understand the importance of having their voices heard, not just for me, but the audience that I have, and amplifying voices in that way. And that's what I love about being a magazine editor as well, is that I get to be able to do that and really amplify, whether they're writers, illustrators, or even, in the last issue of Conscious Being, we interviewed some Indonesian disabled women who are doing remarkable work around climate change. So it's kind of, I guess everything in a way was leading to this point of I've built my platform, I've built my voice, and now it's time to pass the baton and really amplify other more marginalized and intersectional groups within, especially within the disability community. That's the point I'm at, I think. So
yeah, absolutely. I mean, you started talking about multiple things that I wanted to touch on there, in that you kind of said you wanted to provide a platform for other groups, Black, Brown and Indigenous groups. And then you started talking about the Indonesian disabled women that you talked about. And I was wondering, what kind of amazing stories have you come across now that you're trying to kind of share that platform with other groups?
Yeah, I think it ends up being a massive learning curve for me, and what I hope then extends out to the audience, whether it's people listening to the podcast today that we're recording, or whether it's through any of the magazines that I edit or the talks that I give. And it's not that I want to take away from giving these voices the platform, because I'll always try and pass that on when I can. But obviously I want to talk about, when I am talking about disability and climate change and inclusion and diversity, I want to talk about these people and the stories that I have come across, because that gives the opportunity for people to have that awareness and perhaps even reach out and follow these individuals and so on and so forth. And yeah, with the Indonesian women that I interviewed for Conscious Being, I think when it comes to climate change, the issue of Conscious Being was climate change and sustainability focused. And for me, I really wanted to make sure that we were having Black, Brown and Indigenous voice shining through. And so it became the main feature of the article, of the issue, sorry. And with this interview, I think I learned so much that moved me and made me realize that actually, as much as I'm doing as much as I can towards climate change and sustainability, to be as sustainable as I can, what I was missing as an individual was certainly this deeper understanding of the way that climate change and eco-ableism actually impacts disabled people, particularly in the global south. And I've been on this steep learning curve where, I found out things in this interview that absolutely horrified me and frightened me, because as much as I'm aware of the issues around climate change that I'm certainly going to experience as a disabled person, it's nothing compared to what people, particularly in kind of those kind of intersectional groups within the global south, are actually going to experience. So, for example, I spoke to Maria and Yanni for the interview, and Yanni was telling me about how in Indonesia, 7 out of 10 meteorological events that happen are essentially caused by climate change. And then she kind of, her and Maria dug deeper into how that actually impacts the indigenous disabled people in Indonesia. And that includes, you know, farmers who have to make a living, and maybe because of these meteorological events, whether it then ends up being drought or flooding, cannot access their farms, cannot access the forests where the palm trees are, for them to actually make an income or make a living, or they're losing crops, whether due to flooding or drought. But then there's the flip side of that. It's not just about the income. It's also about the fact that if you are disabled, you often have to access kind of, you know, medicines or hospitals or specialists to help you manage your impairment or condition. And if the roads are washed out or flooded for whatever reason, and you cannot access that medical assistance or help that you need because of your impairment or condition, that can impact your day-to-day life in a really devastating way. So, you know, it's not just about income, but it's about quality of life every single day and understanding that. But even in doing the interview, I think with Yanni, she was very passionate about education, and she kind of spoke very much about how disabled people, and she was actually generalizing this to a global kind of perspective, but obviously through that lens of being Indonesian, she was saying that in Indonesia, a lot of disabled people aren't educated enough about climate change and the impact that climate change will have on their life. But she sees that reflected across kind of the global disability community, that there is this lack of deeper understanding in the disability community about how climate change is actually going to impact us as we go forward into the future. And that actually the first step has always got to be about education. And I believe that 100%. I agree with her. I think until the past few years, before I was, you know, kind of educating myself, I was very, you know, I'd kind of maybe kick off about something that I think, well, I can't do that, but, you know, so that's annoying if they change that because of sustainability or climate change. But it's actually expanding your education to being broader than just necessarily how something is going to impact you as an individual or what you can do as an individual yourself. And it has to be that broader perspective and education that we take on board, and leading from that point in terms of activism.
Actually, that kind of fits perfectly with what TSL, the Trust for Sustainable Living, try to do. I think our motto is kind of to educate and empower. So I think
what's important, isn't it? Absolutely. I think no matter what you do, it's got to be about that dissemination of information, and actually valid and scientifically truthful information. I think, you know, I won't go down the rabbit hole, but we certainly live in an age of where there's a lot of misinformation out there, let's say, because there's always going to be political agendas behind things that we have to understand. And certainly when I did the interview with Yanni and Maria, they did touch on the fact that even with the Indonesian government, there's a political agenda around disability and climate change, but it becomes tokenistic in that sense of it's a tick box. It's almost like, look, we have the disabled person here at the table, but then what they're not understanding is that you're bringing a disabled person to the table, but they might not be someone who has that education or information that is going to actually be useful in having the discussion at the table. So I think, yeah, I agree. Education has to be the basis of everything that we do.
Absolutely. And I wanted to go back very quickly to something you mentioned right at the beginning when you said that you'd done some speaking at some events for Twitter and EA, was it?
EA Games. Yeah. How cool is that, right?
I was going to ask, actually, what are some of your favorite events or like speeches that you've given? But it seems like you're going to quite a few big things and beyond.
I mean, I've given a lot over the years, and certainly there's been a majority of my work in the previous kind of or the past decade has been in schools, and I've really loved doing that. I think especially when I've gone in and spoken to kids about disability and given them a safe space to actually explore what disability is, because for me, until we normalize disability in society, there's going to continue to be ableism and discrimination and so many issues for disabled people and barriers that we face. So it's, I see it as very important that we go into schools. So certainly, in terms of importance, I think schools are probably up there at the top of what I do. But that's not to discredit that actually every talk that I do, especially I think around disability, is really important. But there's certainly been a number of favorites which I have been really excited about too. Yeah, I think EA Games, especially for me, I did that one just a few weeks ago. And I think, I'm not an avid gamer, but I'm certainly someone who I love playing like The Sims and stuff like that, a few other games that EA produce. So to be approached by EA Games, and the thing was, I actually spoke to them about eco-ableism and climate change and disability, because they're really, they have kind of affinity groups set up where they have disabled employees get that right, employees kind of employees who are passionate about sustainability and being green as possible, and those were kind of the groups that I was speaking to. So it was really exciting to connect with a company that I love because of gaming, but I could also connect with them as well over kind of eco-ableism and disability and climate change and all of that stuff, and looking at how giving them food for thought around disability and climate change. And one of the nicest kind of feedback comments I got during that session was that I challenged the individual, but in a really beautiful way. And I was like, well, if I'm like, job done, if that's the feedback I'm gonna get. So it was a really special session, that one, definitely.
To challenge the individual in such a beautiful way, that's such a nice thing to say. I'm almost, as in a way, it really is quite nice feedback. I mean, all the time today when you're talking about, challenging and discussing ideas.
I think that's just it. I think, well, like I said, we live in a world currently where there's a lot of division and there's a lot of misinformation out there, and it's a real struggle for everyone, I think, to feel brave enough to actually state an opinion or talk about something. And I think for me, so what's so important about education, actually, because I see, my talks, the work that I do is education. The work that you guys are doing is all about education, and it's got to be about making education a safe space to learn, so that you can feel challenged but not feel attacked in any way. Or because I certainly know, I'm very, I like to think of myself as being very self-aware, and I certainly tap into those moments of, if someone challenges me, I instantly feel a bit defensive and a bit uncomfortable. And because I'm aware of that, I really try and just breathe my way through that feeling, because I know it's not going to be helpful in that instance of actually learning and growth for myself. Because I'm not going to say at all that I'm perfect. I've made mistakes. I've been ableist myself. Disabled people can be ableist as well and can discriminate against other disabled people. I've certainly done that. I've had to do a lot of work on myself, standing in my position as a white person, and how that actually, how I engage around the race conversation, and things like that. And the same with LGBTQAI plus, all of these points of identity or intersection, they're things that can make us feel really uncomfortable. And I think it's important to be able to learn to create that safe space where people can feel challenged, but in a way where they don't feel threatened. And I kind of saw that comment as that that is how that person felt. They felt challenged, but they didn't feel threatened in any way. I wasn't attacking them maybe about beliefs or attitudes that they'd held beforehand, but hopefully in the way that I did that, it's expanded their mind. It's built that moment of education, right? That moment to learn and grow.
And now one of the things that I wanted to kind of talk to you about is something that you've mentioned quite a lot so far, and that's the idea of eco-ableism. Mm-hmm. And this, obviously knowing about the concepts, but not really like having heard the term before and putting the definition to it, I was wondering if you could kind of give us a bit of an idea of what eco-ableism is and how it affects disabled people. Because I came across your article, Climate Change, Disability and Eco-ableism and Why We Need to Be Inclusive to Save the Planet. And I thought that was, I mean, really amazing. I didn't even kind of think of some of the nuances. I mean, my mum uses a wheelchair, she's disabled. And even then, you know, you think being so close, maybe that I would know a bit more, but even some of the things that you said, I hadn't really thought about before. So yeah, I was just kind of wondering if you could give a bit of an idea of what it is and kind of how it affects disabled people.
Absolutely. I think to explain what eco-ableism is, I think I have to explain firstly what ableism is, because that will help. I think that always helps people understand eco-ableism a little bit more. So ableism, essentially, the easiest way I can explain ableism to people is that it is the systemic discrimination of disabled people or other bodies and minds that are in our community. So, you know, disability covers a wide range of impairments and conditions, and this can range from physical disability like myself with limb difference right through to mental health issues. So people who are depressed or have anxiety or have mental illness fall under the disability umbrella legally in terms of the 2010 Equality Act. So disability is quite a broad spectrum, and basically ableism is any form of discrimination that anyone that falls under that umbrella experiences. So that is discrimination, whether it's in the workplace or in the wider community, that you know, you are being discriminated against, whether that's through lack of physical access or whether it's through negative attitudes or beliefs or stereotypes that are happening out there. So it's like the simplest way that I can describe ableism for people. When it comes to eco-ableism, essentially it is that same thing. It is discrimination, but just simply within the kind of eco movement that's out there, or the climate change movement that's out there. And again, that can be whether through to lack of physical access. So for example, if an organization like protest or protest group are setting up a protest of some kind, but maybe they fail to consider whether they're providing a quiet space for, say, someone who's autistic or with mental health issues who maybe needs some time out from the protest to go and do some self-care, or whether they're actually holding the protest near a place that has accessible toilets, or so on and so forth. So it's just, you know, that is eco-ableism in the sense that it is causing discrimination, and that impacts the decision of a disabled person as to whether they're going to attend that protest or not. Right through to actually kind of the kind of policy level of how we impact change. So we're all aware that COP26 is coming up very soon, very, very soon. I can't believe it's kind of like this year's gone so quick. And we all know how important that meeting is, because we all know basically this is our last chance. And actually, even reports that have come out really recently, it's even like, is this, have we actually gone our last chance actually, and now this meeting is really going to become about how much we can minimize the impact of climate change. So but then it's like, okay, on that broader scale at COP26, then at that policy level, at that governmental level, where are the disabled and Black, Brown and Indigenous voices? Are they at the table? And if they are there, why aren't they widely visible? Why aren't they being represented fully? So it's kind of like these and then it's everything in between about where disabled people are being excluded from the eco and climate change movement. So that essentially is eco-ableism. So in the article as well, I mentioned quite a few things about how kind of along that kind of scale of impact, that how actually eco-ableism impacts disabled people. Probably the most obvious example I can give is actually even within my own space of home where I'm sitting here. So I live on a main road in Leeds in Northern England, and I do congratulate Leeds Council because they've put in a cycle path that goes basically all around Leeds, and it's on the footpath opposite where I live. And there's also a pedestrian path there as well. And they've popped signs up where they give you information of how long it's going to take you to cycle, as well as to walk, as well as to get a taxi into town from the point where I live. So I live about a 20 minute drive from the city centre, and they have, it's about a 30 to 40 minute cycle ride into town, or it's about an hour's to walk into town, so on and so forth. But the point being is that I can't ride a bike and I can't walk long distances. So I immediately feel excluded in that sense of where's my option, because what you find is, and again, this is what I mentioned in the article, that it's not just my city, but it's a lot of cities actually globally that are really pedestrianizing and making cycle friendly the inner city centers of their cities, which is great. I'm not against that in any way, shape or form, but what happens with this is that then a lot of access for disabled people gets eliminated within the city centers. So disabled parking might be taken out or extremely minimized within city centers. Streets that are then made either pedestrian or just for buses and taxis then eliminates that option for disabled people to maybe access the city centres. So all I think, I kind of ask around that sense, and that's around design, sustainable design and eco-design, whether it's the streets that we live in or the houses or communities that we live in, is to always include that disabled voice when it comes to how this is going to work in the city. How can we make it work? Because I think it's not that disabled people are against sustainable solutions, but all we're asking for is that we have our perspective and our access and inclusion needs met within that design process. The same can be said about plastic straws. Certainly, we know that there's an issue with plastics in the community or globally around the world. But there are certain disabled people in the disability community that need plastic straws or other plastic equipment. Actually, there's other single-use plastics out there that actually, to go even deeper than the plastic straws, are needed by disabled people to stay alive. Whether it's syringes or tubes, if people have a feeding tube that they need, or right through to even masks. There's been a lot of controversy about masks, in the past 18 months with the pandemic. But these are all single-use plastics that potentially there are some disabled people need to even stay alive, let alone just to drink a hot drink while they're out at a cafe, being social and having a good day-to-day living experience with their friends. So again, it's so complex, but a lot of this feeds back into as well the fact that whether it's plastics, whether it's fuel consumption, so on and so forth, again, it's coming back to the individual gets blamed for their impact on the environment when we know deep down that, you know, when it comes to plastic, say in the ocean, that it's the fishing industry that actually is the biggest criminal in that, not the disabled person needing a plastic straw maybe once in a while in the cafe. And, you know, when it comes to fuel, we certainly know that it's not necessarily just going to be the disabled person that needs to use their car to go to the supermarket to pick up some supplies, maybe once a week or once a fortnight, as opposed to, you know, you think of the billionaires that have their private jets fly all over the world. You know, I think that's the a lot of the issue with eco-ableism is that disabled people get blamed a lot for not doing enough or not doing anything at all, when actually in the grand scheme of things, the things that we need to either have a good quality of life and feel included or to even stay alive are really minuscule compared to actually a lot of these bigger issues that we face. So that was a bit of a ramble. The thing is with eco-ableism is that it's very complex and I can only talk really about a few things, otherwise we'll be here for hours. But hopefully that's given the listeners a little bit of an idea of that complexity that we kind of face as disabled people within the eco and climate change movement.
No, definitely. I think it was, like you said, it's such a big and complex issue. So even though you felt like you were rambling, you probably didn't even cover half of all of the aspects that actually go into it. But
exactly,
you're right. When we're talking about things like single-use plastics, so right at the beginning, when that kind of campaign was going on, I was all for it until, you know, I think I came across a post on social media that kind of showed all the different alternatives to plastic straws and you know, how they're not necessarily great for people with disabilities, whatever those disabilities may be, in terms of metal straws or reusable straws mm-hmm. being harder to clean. And if somebody hasn't got kind of like complete hand movement, for example, that could be harder, and then you don't want to kind of have germs. Or if it's a hard straw, obviously, and somebody experiences involuntary movements, that could be quite dangerous. So there's loads of different things that plastic straws are a better alternative for them. And it's, like you said, a bit of a ridiculous issue to focus on because they're less than 1% of the waste in the ocean and fishing nets are like 40%.
Yes, exactly.
So I think it is important to kind of study or look at least the wider context and all the people that need things or that use things when we look at policies and start talking about what needs to be done. And actually you started covering this already kind of in multiple of your answers, but I was going to ask kind of what steps need to be taken by groups and governments and in policies to make things more inclusive of disabled people. But obviously you've already spoken about giving people a voice and having perspective heard, but you know, is there anything else that's particularly important to making things more inclusive?
Yeah, I think it's making sure that you know, obviously, yes, like I said, it's making sure that you're following disabled activists, disabled people, and again, making sure that they're that you have a wide range of intersectional disabled people that you're following on social media or that you're engaging with or that you're watching videos from. But I think as well, if you're an organization, if you're a business or a school or a government, I think it's actually when you're talking about inclusion and diversity, whether that is in the more general sense or it is within climate change, the climate change movement or climate change policy, it's about making sure that you are not forgetting disability. Quite often when people talk about inclusion and diversity, they'll talk about everything but disability. And the irony is that disabled people make up over 15% of the global population. There are over 1 billion disabled people living in this world currently, globally. And we just get ignored, even though we are the biggest marginalized group and actually the most intersectional, because you can be Black, Brown and Indigenous and disabled, you can be LGBTQIA plus and disabled, you can be young and disabled, old and disabled, you know, any gender, whatever, it doesn't matter. Like, disability can impact absolutely anyone out there. And so it always astounds me when disability gets left off the list around inclusion and diversity. So what I would say to people, again, like I said, schools, organizations, charities, governments, big business, whatever, it doesn't matter. If you are having those discussions around inclusion and diversity, and access and climate change, make sure that you are getting disabled speakers or consultants or specialist scientists. You know, I don't care whether it's me or not. That's not why I do this. And that's the thing. I'm not an expert. I'm not a scientist. I would encourage people to go out there and get scientists, disabled scientists to come in, or designers, sustainability designers or specialists, whatever, to come in and talk about this stuff from the disability perspective. The voices have to be there, and you can't just forget about disability, because ultimately disabled people are the ones that are going to be and are already being disproportionately affected by climate change. And, you know, it's like one of the most ridiculous things. So I grew up in Sydney, Australia, and I am thinking about moving back there in the future. And I was reading an article the other week, and they're basically, I think, saying that by 2030, there will be areas of Sydney that will regularly be flooded and underwater. So they were talking about, well, how can we like redesign houses to make them safe from this flooding that's going to come? And so many of them were, you know, the suggestions were around, making so like in northern Queensland particularly, they have a lot of houses that are built on stilts, so they're raised up because they've experienced flooding up there for years, and often that's stairs to get up into the house. Now, for a lot of disabled people, they can't use stairs. It's not like, you know, if you're having flooding, it's not like you can have a lift installed, because obviously if the lift is getting flooded, it's going to impact that. You can't use it. You know, so maybe it's got to be a ramp in some way. But then there are some disabled people that have issues and can't use ramps for whatever reason. So it's just this complete ignorance or dismissing of a voice that is actually going to be disproportionately impacted by whether it's flooding or drought or extreme storms or whatever climate change is going to look like within that city, that country or that space. And you need to have those voices there. And if you can have those specialist voices there that really have that in-depth knowledge, that are really going to support those decisions made around policy or support those decisions made around sustainable and good ecological design for when it comes to climate change. So what I would just suggest to people is that if you are inviting people in to have those discussions, look through the list that you have. Do any of them openly identify as disabled? Are you approaching disabled people to actually come on board? And if you're not, then maybe stop yourself and really do a little bit of, coming back to that word, education, educating yourself a little bit about where you need to go and where you need to look and who you need to invite in to participate and have that seat at the table.
Absolutely. I think that's really important, actually, and something that here at TSL we will and should and will continue to hopefully take on board. I mean, next year we have a summit, as we do every year, which is kind of like a 5-day, 6-day summit, talking around a specific theme related to the environment of climate change. I think next year we're going to focus on things like climate justice and inclusion. So kind of round topic to what we're talking about. And it's making sure that we actually fill that with the relevant people then. We can't talk to, you know, just white, completely able-bodied people and then expect the discussion to be useful, obviously.
Yeah. It's absolutely, you've hit the nail on the head. It's completely useful. A solution to climate change is completely useful if it's going to then completely exclude a particular marginalized group. So, you know, that's why you know, I know there are people out there that scoff at inclusion and diversity and all of that stuff. But honestly, if you start from a point of inclusion and diversity, and you're making sure that you're covering all those voices, then actually solutions to things are going to be naturally inclusive and more robust. And like I said earlier, with disability, it can, and I never say this to scare people, because I think a lot of people are very scared of disability. They're scared of what that lived experience is like. And a lot of this is because of really negative stereotypes and representation around disability. But so I don't say this to scare people, but the odds are that if you are non-disabled, you are going to be impacted by disability at some time in your life, whether it's you as an individual or it's someone that you love. And so you have to make sure that you are including those voices in all of these discussions and events and things like that. Because ultimately, if you don't have those discussions and set up those solutions now as they are, then trust me, if you end up disabled in the future, or a loved one ends up disabled in the future, you're going to be kicking yourself, because you'll be like, why didn't I do this? Because actually those solutions would have, you know, really positively impacted and supported me or my loved one. So it's not about, you know, scaring people into it, but just saying, you know, it's a reality that especially as people get older, they're more likely to be impacted by different impairments and conditions. So it's like, why not set up not just kind of society in general, but also climate change solutions to be as inclusive and accessible as possible now, so that as our populations grow older or actually even have disability caused by more pandemics. We know with long COVID that there's been a growing number of people becoming disabled because of long COVID, or even impairment and conditions acquired through actual climate change events, that we actually have the solutions and the support set up already for the disabled community as we move forward.
Absolutely. Actually, something that I have previously kind of seen online is the discussion around it just makes sense to make the world more accessible from the get-go. Because, yeah. I mean, on a very basic level, we all get older and
yes.
things get harder. So doesn't it just make sense?
I think it does. Exactly. And this is what I don't understand, is why it's so hard for a lot of people to understand about access. And it's not to say that I'm perfect with access. I've had to learn, because I edit digital magazines, I've had to learn very quickly a lot about digital access. You know, my impairment affects my limbs. It doesn't affect my hearing or my sight. So I wasn't aware of a lot of the things that hearing, hard of hearing people and visually impaired people need to access digitally, you know, documents, magazines, social media posts and that online. So, you know, it's certainly a lot about that. Again, coming back to education, it's that continuous educating of yourself and sharing what you learn with others to have that ripple effect of education going out that really makes the biggest impact for disabled people. So it's just making sure that you're willing to learn and grow and enact the things that you learn about, so that it can have a positive and more inclusive impact in wider society.
Definitely. As we kind of move forward with the interview, something that I wanted to ask you about was how has your experience with being a Paralympian, mm-hmm. and, you know, that extreme effort, that constant training, kind of influenced your activism and the work that you do at the moment?
Okay, interesting, because I grew up in a very non-disabled family. So I was the only person with a disability in my family. And my parents fought for me to go to mainstream school. So I was the only child with a physical disability, actually with any disability that I was aware of, at both my primary and high school. So I kind of grew up with this belief that oh, I'm not disabled. Like, I'm just like everyone else. And which, you know, in to a certain degree, I am just like, I'm a human being. I'm like everyone else in that sense. It wasn't until I kind of started competing at the Paralympics or training for the Paralympics that I really started interacting with other disabled kids and other disabled adults, which really grew my awareness. And I think what was really important about it was that even though I felt like growing up that I was like everyone else, there was still this underlying feeling of I'm different and there's no one else out there who looks like me. And how does that actually look for my future then? So kind of being in the Paralympics, it really broadened my perspective of, wow, there are people out there who are like me, who are successful and are facing similar barriers to myself and having to fight these barriers. So I'd really say that the Paralympics were that awakening of there are a lot of issues out there that not just myself experiences, but as we know, over a billion disabled people globally are experiencing to very different and varying degrees. And I don't want disabled children coming up behind me to experience those same barriers of myself. So that's really kind of what kickstarted my activism. So much so that when I was at uni doing fine art, I really focused a lot on disabled artists and exploring my disability identity through my art, which then led on to my speaking, where I started off speaking a lot about the Paralympics. And that then kind of led into more focusing on disability, because I was finding that a lot of kids at schools, I'd talk about the Paralympics, but they'd want to know more about my disability. So that kind of shifted more to that angle of actually, this is becoming a safe space to talk about disability with kids that maybe wouldn't necessarily feel comfortable asking their parents these questions or anything like that. So it all kind of snowballed to this point now where actually my life is about disability, not just from my everyday lived experience, but also that desire and motivation to make a positive change. So I don't try to, you know, it's a bit coming back to that comment from EA Games. I want to challenge people beautifully. So I don't want to attack people when they get it wrong, because I know in myself that I've got it wrong before in a lot of different ways, not just around disability, but around race, by around, you know, gender and sexuality and all of that stuff, because I'm only a human being and I'm a product of the community that I grew up in, and I'll always have something to learn. So I want to stand from that point of activism of being a giving and welcoming activist. So I want to be someone who is willing to have a chat with someone and challenge their ideas, but coming back to that thing of not making them feel threatened or defensive about the perspective that they're coming from. And I think so much of that has really stemmed from the Paralympics and having those initial discussions and exposure to disability in that wider context, that has really allowed me to see that this is an opportunity to make positive change for all of those coming up behind me in a gentle way, let's say.
Yes. And so we've looked at the Paralympics, but one of the things I wanted to ask you about is actually your magazine. So as we've kind of mentioned, you're an editor for a number of publications. You have your own magazine. Specifically, I want to talk about Conscious Being, a magazine for disabled women, by disabled women. And in issue one, I saw that you had a feature called Sustainability or Disability, and you've talked a little bit about tick boxes so far, in that there's a bit of a either or mindset in the beauty and fashion industries. Mm-hmm. They either try and tick the sustainability box or the accessibility box, mm-hmm. you know, but it rarely kind of covers both, or the nuances and the kind of interactions between sustainability and accessibility. And I was wondering why you think that is.
I just think there's a lot, you know what, I think we see it in representation as well, not just even just the actual products of things. But I think for a lot of organizations and businesses, I think it's just too much. I think it's almost like, you know, when they say, you know, try and hold two thoughts in your mind at the same time, and it's virtually impossible to do. Like it's really hard to do that. And I think this is the danger of why a lot of businesses end up being a bit tick boxy, because it's hard for them to understand that all of this stuff, so whether it's accessibility, whether it's sustainability, whether it's representation, whether it's inclusion, that they're all tied up together in a sense. They're all interlinked. But I think it's hard for a lot of people to understand that, because they kind of think, well, we can only focus on the getting the sustainability right. But then it's like, but that's a design process that you're going through. So why don't you have accessibility at the start of that design process as well? So as you're working towards sustainable solutions, keeping that disability accessibility, you know, as part of that process as well, is actually possible to do. And it saves you a lot of time and effort and money as a business from then having to go back to the start again and maybe going through that process again around accessibility. So, you know, and it's the same with representation. It's the same as, you know, the example of my housemate is British Indian, and we've had this a lot of discussions. We have a lot of interesting discussions around racism and ableism and all of that stuff. You know, I remember having this discussion with her about Band-Aids. So, you know, when Band-Aids were first created, they're the flesh color of a white person. Right, so the color that we get, it blends in more so with white skin. But more recently, and very recently, and it's really, really disgusting that it's only a very recent thing, is that now a lot of Band-Aid companies are now offering different tones of skin color on Band-Aid or plasters, I should say. I'm saying the Aussie version of it is Band-Aids, or the brand name of it. But with plasters, it's like, why is it only now that that they're now offering options for different skin colors for black and brown people to use? And it's almost like if we just at the beginning of the design of anything that we're doing, if we make sure that we are having access for not, and actually that means, you know, the plaster example does mean access essentially for not just disabled people, but black, brown, and Indigenous people. You know, if we have that from the get-go of a design process, then you're being inclusive all the way through. And that's a really important thing to keep in mind. So I think that the issue comes about from a lot of businesses get so stuck on a particular aspect of, and we know certainly right now that sustainability is very quote unquote in, like it's the current favorite thing to be focusing on, even though it should just be standard through all of design, that is what a lot of organizations and businesses are going to focus on. But the point being is that you can focus on more than one thing through a design process. It doesn't have to just be all sustainability, and then we'll tackle accessibility later. It's like, actually, just tackle it all now from the beginning, and make it as just part of your core process of the product that you're making or the service that you're offering or whatever that might be, and you will just save yourself a lot of time and money and heartache as you kind of go through. So I think it's just, yeah, it's getting organizations and businesses just to understand that you can hold these two concepts in your mind at the same time and drive them forward through your organization as you go, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And actually, something I was going to say is, you know, one of the ways to kind of, as you were saying, keep those two thoughts into your head is to combine it, make it part of the process. Mm-hmm. Don't keep it as two thoughts, make it automatic, which is difficult when you're talking about your actual thoughts. But if you were to, you know, include Black, Brown, Indigenous and disabled people in your process, then it becomes automatic. It's not something that you need to think about. Have you done this? Have you included
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Already involved in the system.
Absolutely. And that's not to say that, you know, as organizations, as businesses, you're never going to get it right from the get-go, because you won't. I know from myself, starting a magazine, starting Conscious Being, that we've had some issues, and it's probably going to be constantly ironing out of issues and processes. But the point is, as a team, we're keeping in mind access, representation, and mental health and well-being. And as we step forward, we're making sure that we're putting down the processes as we're going that that will automate a lot of this stuff for us, so that, you know, once you get into the future, once we get to future issues, it's just really organic and natural to make sure that you are hitting all of these targets. And yeah, okay, it might not be easy at the start, but it'll give you a lot less headaches further on down the track if you're making sure you're hitting those targets around inclusion and diversity and accessibility as you go along.
Definitely. And now, as we come towards the end of this interview, I have a couple more questions. The first of which is, where can people go to follow you, your activism, or, you know, your products and your projects that you work on, such as Conscious Being? Where can they go to kind of find those and support more of your work?
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter and Instagram mostly. So on Twitter, if you just search for me, you should be able to find me. My handle's a bit of a weird one because it's an anagram of my middle name. It's at Esau. So yeah, it might be a bit complicated, but if you search for Elizabeth Wright, you should be able to find me. On Instagram, I'm at Elizabeth L. Wright. You can also find Conscious Being and Not Your Monolith, the other magazine I edit, and Disability Review Magazine, the other magazine I edit as well. You can find all of those on social media. Currently, Conscious Being is a digital magazine on Flipsnack. It's housed on the platform Flipsnack, but we will be going to print for our third issue, and we're busy trying to find, obviously, sustainable and recyclable options to do that. We want to stand by our values 100%, so we're looking for those options, but we will be going to print, and we're just having the website made currently for Conscious Being Magazine, and that will be consciousbeingmagazine.com once that website's up. And that's where you'll be able to find the link for Flipsnack, purchase the magazine, and also sign up to our newsletter and, and get really involved with the community, which would be wonderful.
Fabulous. And now, to kind of finish off and seal the deal, something that we have been asking our guests from this season is to kind of, right at the end, if you had the chance now to sit down with the world leaders, talk about climate action and environmentalism, you know, especially in terms of underrepresented groups, kind of what advice, what words of wisdom, and what would you say to those world leaders?
Wow, that's kind of heavy. It feels a bit heavy. I kind of think if I was showing up at the table, I would implore them to not listen to me, actually. I'd actually implore them to not listen to my words, but to reach out to certain individuals and certain organizations within the disability movement and bring them on board, to please bring them on board, and to listen to them and to have them an active part of your policy and design planning for every stage of how you're going to deal with climate change and sustainability. And then I would probably hand them over a list of the contact details for all of these individuals and organizations. And then I would sit at the table with them and make them call these people while I'm sitting there, and invite them to the table. Because I don't want to be a cynic, but I feel like a lot, especially in the past few years, with a lot of governments, a lot of very big organizations, that there's a lot of words being said, but not a lot of action being taken. So I would literally say to them, don't listen to me, because I'm not the expert you need to listen to. I'm just someone who is passionate about being part of the movement and wants to do as much as I can within my limited capacity to talk about this and raise awareness. But these are the people you need to speak to. These are the people you need at the table. And I'm not leaving until I know 100% for certain that they're going to show up, that they're going to be invited and shown up. So that's what I do. that's what I do in a nutshell.
It's perfect. I think it's important. And I think I would sit with you there and make sure to.
Yeah.
If we are invited to the table in the first place.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, that's it for today. And this has been amazing to get to talk to you and to connect with you. And I'm so thankful that you could come and talk to us and our listeners today. I think it's been very important. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jasmine. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
This has been Speaking of Sustainability, a podcast by the Trust for Sustainable Living. Thank you to today's guest, Elizabeth Wright. Hosted by Jasmine Barrett. Organised by Jasmine Barrett and Sunny Denny. Music by Billy Painter. Find us online by going to trustforsustainableliving.org. Thank you for listening.